Good morning, diners and travelers. Welcome to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And what is on our agenda today, this morning, Robert?
Well, I'm here, first of all. That's pretty remarkable, I guess, in and of itself. I mean, it's not like I'm not here every week, but this is Peter, just in case you're wondering. It's really funny. Sometimes, listeners, we get a lot of phone calls, and it's really quite surprising to me how frequently when people call and I answer the phone, people will say, Ann? As though there's no difference. I'm sure you listeners are smart enough to be able to tell the difference between us. But there's
the taller.
I'm the taller one. There's a big difference between run-of-the-mill products and really excellent products. And we have two products to start off today's program, absolutely at the top of their game: Effie's corn cakes and oat cakes.
Called Effie's Homemade.
Yeah, Effie's Homemade won the big Sophie at the Fancy Food Show. They won Best New Product.
Cookie.
But I thought, they won Best New Cookie, right?
Cookie.
Right, the Best New Product in the whole thing is on in a couple of weeks' time, so we can't tell you who that is just yet because we have to keep it as a surprise. And then our next guest learned how to make gelato in Argentina when he was working in business finance, and he liked it so much, he decided that he'd found a company which he named after the person who invented gelato, and we also think invented ice cream back in the 16th or 17th century, whose name was Buonatalenti. So his product's called Talenti, and these are the most luxurious gelati and sorbets you've ever tasted in your whole life. And we haven't finished all we have yet, but it's hanging by a thread. And I'm responsible for eating most of them because they're so delicious.
I'm getting insecure that we're not going to be having them.
Your mouth will water when you hear about them, and your mouth will crunch at the thought of Effie's. So here we go with Effie's, followed by Talenti.
I have a new addiction, and it's called Effie's Homemade. I'm talking now to Joan McIsaac and Irene Costella, who are co-founders and co-operators of this wonderful treat. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Your company, first of all, I guess we can get some of the history if we address the name. Why is it called Effie's Homemade?
Oh, I think I'll answer that one. This is Joan. Effie is my mom, and when we started this company, we knew we were going to launch it with my mother's oat cake recipe from Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. And once we saw how pretty her name was, too, and in honor of her inspiration for us, we decided to name the company after her.
Now, this is a traditional product of Ireland and Scotland, right?
Yes, it is.
So Cape Breton, I guess, was settled by people from both places, so that's really sort of why it came from there, I guess.
Exactly. It could go all the way back to, I think, the Isle of Skye is where some of those recipes were coming from in Scotland, and then it transformed into the versions that you have up in Nova Scotia.
Which are also very different from the traditional Irish or Scottish oat cake. So
right.
Our product has butter in it, which is different from the English oat cake or Scottish oat cake, as well as a little bit of sweetening.
Yes, so it's heading part of the way to being a shortbread, I guess.
Partially, yes, but it's a firm one, and it's not as soft of a crumb on the biscuit.
Now, you're suggesting it as a sort of a not-too-sweet snack with a cup of tea in the afternoon, something served with cheese and perhaps fruit. Why that way? Why not more of a conventional cookie replacement?
Oh, I think one of our strongest selling points is that it pairs so fabulously with other products. And for retailers who have a beautiful wedge of blue cheese that they want to try to sell, this helps to pair that. Our initial instinct here was it's fabulous with a cup of tea. It's fabulous with a cup of coffee or whatever you're drinking, or even port after dinner. But really, once we realized how well it paired with other cheeses, it just makes a great combination. So it's a very unique, versatile biscuit.
Now tell me this. This is the product that won the Gold Sophie.
Yes.
How does it feel to, I mean, of course, you've been in the culinary field for a while, but this is declared by this Gold Sophie as the best cookie in the country, right?
And I think Irene should answer that.
I'm still giddy.
also want to say what I think this award means. It somewhat validates what we felt about our cookie. It's like, well, there's a lot of fabulous products out there, and we have to admit that, of course. We all enjoy them every day, but when that validates that retailers, they know and acknowledge what we are making is really that high of a quality, it just was a great pat on the back. And it really helped us acknowledge
a huge number of submissions for this award. Yeah. I don't know. I don't have the figures right at hand, but it's thousands.
Yeah.
Cookies and crackers is a big category, too.
Yeah, right.
So you did something really special here. Now, and we agree. Anne just loves them. She doesn't eat crackers. But she eats oat cakes and corn cakes. The corn cakes are almost all gone already.
Yeah, I know. There's a crumb there.
There's a crumb left. She's a crumb for me, that's all.
Now, tell us your third product. Now, you opened 2.5 years ago with one product, right? And then when did you debut the second one? Was that the corn cake?
Yes, we debuted that at the Fancy Food Show last year.
Okay.
So that came out just about a little over a year ago.
And that's anise-scented?
It has anise
seeds.
It's not
okay.
A flavoring. It's actually the seed. And you really don't get that anise unless you bite the seed, which is really interesting to
really?
People because it's a lingering finish.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I mean, I guess I recognize it from biscotti, which I was raised on. And then now you've also just come out with, this year, you debuted a third product, which is?
It is a pecan nut cake.
Well, you girls know how to go right after.
Go right for the pecans while we can. Yeah, we were experimenting, actually, with another biscuit, and I'm just like, well, I just love pecans. I love pecans. Let's just do this with pecans. We did. We love it, and we're using a beautiful wildflower honey, and we're also using stone-ground whole wheat, which gives it a little bit more substance, and at the same time, almost gives it that graham, very homey flavor,
uh-huh.
Because a graham cracker is actually, graham flour is actually a whole wheat flour, so it tends to give it a much more homier flavor for me, and fabulous with like a nice refreshing glass of lemonade or even a glass of milk. This is the kind of biscuit where I want to have a big glass of milk with it.
Do you have any other plans, new products?
We do, and it's not going to be in the same line. We feel like three is perfect. The trilogy is finished with the biscuits, the tea biscuits. And when, in years past, when we had a catering business, I used to make all my crackers there, and I really loved the next somewhat. I'll tell you, it's more in the cracker family, and I don't want to say it right now because
okay.
We are testing it for shelf life right now.
Oh, no. Well, people might steal your idea before you have a chance to get to market. We understand.
Exactly. Not that I want to be, you know. But I do, we are testing it right now, so I'm very excited about it.
Do you know Mary? Mary's Gone Crackers?
Yes.
Isn't she wonderful?
Yes. Yes. See a lot of them at the Fancy Food Show.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sure, they're all there now.
I love all of her stuff, twigs and the whole thing, sticks and twigs.
I can get a word
in. I think we can promise that this next line will have a very unique aspect to it.
Right.
You know what? I don't have a chance. I got three ladies on here. I don't have a chance, but the most important thing about this product, we haven't done anything about it yet.
Where do you get it?
Which is how you get some.
Oh, Irene.
Well, we are in probably 550 stores across the country, and on our website, we have a store locator. So it's EffiesHomemade.com, and you can find us on, look up by state and see where we are. And we also have, sell the product on our own website. Order right
oh,
off
good.
The
And that's the same
website.
Thing, EffiesHomemade.com?
That's right.
And we ship anywhere in the continental United States.
Right.
Oh, there you go. Well, it's so if you're in Hawaii or Alaska, tough noogies, guys.
If you're in Canada, and we're getting a lot of requests from Canadians. So
what you do then? You know.
It's a bit like reverse bootlegging.
Don't give me any ideas.
meet up at the border and trade some whiskey for some crackers.
Really? Let's start throwing boxes over the fence.
Well, ladies, you have done an outstanding job, and thank you for sharing your product and your conversation with us. And I can't wait to see the crackers. Please
Great.
Keep us posted.
We will absolutely keep you posted, and we so appreciate what you're doing for us right now, and we love it. And now we're going to be listening to your podcast.
Great. Thank you again.
Thank you so much. Thank you again.
Bye-bye.
Have a great weekend.
You
Bye-bye.
Too. Josh Hochschuler, I asked if you were the founder of this company, Talenti, and you said yes. And I said, what does that mean?
Please explain.
Okay, sure. I started this company from scratch in 2003. I had been living for many years in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Oh.
And learned the craft of making gelato there from a group of Italians that had been making it for 40 years.
Really? I mean, were you in the food business?
I wasn't. I was actually in finance and banking, and just when I was living in Argentina, fell in love with gelato and gelaterias, and teamed up with this family that had been making it for so many years, and they taught the craft, the procedures, the recipes, and everything.
Was their name Talenti?
No. Actually, they're nothing to do with Talenti. They had a different name, a different brand, and when I came back to the state, I chose that name, Talenti.
Why did you choose that? Does it mean something?
Yes, it does. Actually, the person who created gelato and ice cream, for that matter, in the 1500s was a gentleman by the name of Bernardo Buontalenti.
Oh,
isn't that wonderful?
And yeah.
You learn something on every program.
So he had been he was alive in the 1500s and working for Catherine de Medici.
Oh, sure, Queen Catherine.
Yep, and at one of the banquets, he served gelato as dessert. It was kind of his grand finale, and it was a huge hit. And we took his name as a trip because we tried to stay true to that old world approach of making gelato.
Now, Catherine de Medici went off to Paris, so maybe she took Mr. Talenti along with her.
Actually, I think she did.
There we go.
She went there and he spread kind of this new craft amongst the French.
Now, let's first of all say, listeners, this is absolutely wonderful stuff.
Yeah, and you have to understand that Peter has eaten all of it.
we don't eat very much in the way of desserts in this house. But I don't know how many containers you sent us, but there's a lot less than there was when we started.
All right, I'm happy to hear that.
And everyone's more delicious than the last. I think the Lisbon lemon was the first one to get finished.
Yeah, you like that one.
And the blood orange wasn't far behind. But let's do something basic for listeners, because I get confused about the difference between gelato and sorbetto. So
actually, the big difference is between gelato and ice cream.
Okay, well,
let's start with that one.
Why don't we do all three? We start with ice cream and then say, now, gelato is like this, but it's not, and then do sorbetto after that.
Okay, sure. So, but gelato would be against traditional ice cream here in the States, because gelato has milk as its base. Ice cream tends to use more cream than milk. Gelato is made with majority being milk rather than cream, and due to that, it has a lower in fat. It's about a third less fat. That's the first major difference.
And it's a little less cloying as well in flavor, right?
The flavor of gelato is very potent. It's very emphasized.
Right. Okay, so that's a deliberate difference from ice cream.
That would be, yes. Yes, and that has also to do with the fact that gelato has a lot of solids rather than liquid. So where ice cream might have a high water content, the gelato is going to have, if it's chocolate, it's going to have a lot of chocolate. If it's coconut, it's going to have a lot of coconut meat and that sort of thing.
Okay.
The other main difference is gelato has very little air added to it. Just through the process of making gelato, air is incorporated when you beat it and spin it and agitate it. But ice cream, they actually generally air is added into ice cream, so it's a much fluffier, different consistency. Gelato is able to maintain a velvety consistency and a different texture.
Okay.
And then finally, gelato often, and in our case in particular, is made with all natural ingredients. There's no additives, no preservatives. It's made in small batches. And the ingredients are really critical to final outcome, the final product.
Now, I mean, what's the difference between your operation and...
Well, hold on. No, we missed a piece out because we didn't define...
We didn't do the sorbetto as opposed to sorbet.
Oh,
sure.
Or as opposed to gelato, for that matter.
So the main difference is going to be that sorbetto is a water base. It has no dairy. Because of that, it makes it fat-free. The sorbetto is often, made with real fruit. It's not some sort of different puree or flavoring. And I suppose you could compare it to a sherbet or a sorbet here in the States. That would be its counterpart. But, again, sorbetto is going to have less air. And it's going to have some of the same procedures and approaches that gelato has.
Yeah, you know, I think that you have the statement here that we should say that it is not made from condensed or hormone-laden milk and or cream. It is not made with high fructose corn syrup. Instead, you use fine pure cane sugar, no artificial flavors and syrups, and that high, and it's not high in butterfat, you already said that, and it's small batch, not a huge thing. Is that the answer to the question I was starting to ask, is how does your product, Salenti, differ from one of the best known gelato operations in this country, which is Ciabella Gelato?
And everything you just said is true. I can't speak to Ciabella as much, but yes, we here at Salenti, we take no shortcuts. We have a labor-intensive process. It's part of the old world approach. Our ingredients are often, are always of the highest quality and often are more costly because of that, but we don't use liquid sweeteners. We use granulated pure sugar, pure cane sugar, and some of those other characteristics that you just named really differentiate us. Our chocolates come from Belgium. We melt them down ourselves. Our nut pastes are made from real nuts with no additives, preservatives, artificial colorings, or anything of that nature. And by staying focused on the quality of the ingredients, that they be all natural, that it be a healthy alternative, easy to digest and enjoy as an indulgent treat, that really has led to the popularity of our product.
Yeah, I mean, you are a big success, aren't you?
Thank God we're now one of the best-selling gelato in the country.
Oh, wow. Well, that's really great. That's really great. I mean, that's a great job from starting from scratch, landing back in this country. I mean, what made you decide? Well, we can now ask, afterwards we can probably ask more easily the reason why you decided to become a gelato manufacturer rather than a banker. since there's less downside risk, I guess.
I suppose in retrospect, yeah.
But it's not an intuitively obvious move.
No, not at all. It's kind of following a passion and a dream and something that's exciting and getting involved in something that I believed in and with an incredible product and something I wanted to share with this country that just was very difficult to find here.
Now, where are you based?
We're based in Dallas, Texas.
Okay, so you're manufacturing in Dallas, Texas?
Correct. Yep, I'm originally from Dallas, and when I moved back to the States, I therefore came to Dallas.
Well, let's say that there's at least one good thing that comes out of Texas.
That's not
amongst
a very nice
many
comment.
People proud
I know,
of here.
I know. I was just talking to an old friend who happens to be from Texas, and he's
pretty, oh really?
He's a pretty good guy too. But Anne was particularly not terribly fond of Texas.
Oh yeah. Have you guys been to Dallas?
Yes.
I think Anne's only been once, and she said I don't really want to go back.
Oh wow.
I've been any number of times only because of when you travel on business, you travel to population centers, so my travels have taken me through Texas quite a lot.
Well, next time you come to Texas, you'll have to come to our manufacturing facility and see how everything's made, see the chocolate we use, the vanilla beans that we bring in from Papua New Guinea, and all of the lengths we go to for our raw materials and our ingredients and our procedures.
Well, now, you don't make any weird flavors.
Depends what you mean by weird.
Well, years ago, I said to Peter, because I don't have a particularly sweet tooth, I said, I wish that they made the ice cream in flavors that I liked, like eggplant and asparagus and artichokes.
Well, you got edamame.
And now we've had edamame. Yeah, we had. But that gelateria, or it's called Laboratorio di Gelato in Philadelphia, is it, or in New York?
I don't know.
But he's doing all those, you know, he has hot chili gelato and all kinds of experimental flavors.
So if you get bored with inventing new ingredients in the sweet line, all you need to do is get in touch with Anne, and she'll be your consultant on what kinds of...
Yeah, we could do green peppercorn.
You could do all kinds of interesting things. Now, let's make sure that we don't close out before recording where you can get this wonderful stuff. I know you can get it online, but where can you get it through distribution as well, like Whole Foods and places like that?
Yes, you know, we are we're located in supermarkets across the country, but our presence in your region would be in Giant Eagle.
Okay, I've seen it at Giant Eagle.
Yep, we have a very nice selection at Giant Eagle, and there's both sorbetto and gelato available there. And we encourage everyone to please go out and give it a try. I think
well, of course,
will love it.
We're heard around the country and around the world. So what about finding places in other states in the country?
So in all different the conventional grocers, the natural chains as well, like Whole Foods, like you mentioned, as well as the specialty stores, really in all different parts of the entire country. Most conventional grocers should be able to find it. Where Florida will be in all the public.
Well, do you have a store finder? On your website, do you have a store finder?
Yes, if people go to talentigelato.com, they can find the list of different stores that carry our product.
And, of course, you sell online through the talentigelato.com website as well.
Correct. They could also buy it online, yes.
Well, you're not at the fancy food show, are you?
The one in New York coming up. No, we're not going to be there.
And we're not either. So we always go. But
we already tasted one of the Year's Grape products. What do we need to go there for?
Oh, I know. So anyhow, so you're having a very fulfilled life, Josh, huh?
Thank God, yes. Everything is going well and enjoying working on this an unbelievable project of in helping introduce gelato to the nation.
Well, I have one other question. Is it comes in such nice containers. We don't know what to do with the containers when we've emptied them.
Well, I forgot to tell you one thing. They're not dishwashers. They're not dishwasher safe.
Oh, they're not.
No,
oh,
I tried.
Did you try that?
I tried one and was thinking about keeping all these because they're very elegant containers, but they don't hold up to the hot water in the dishwasher. So.
Did it melt?
I see. Well, I have to tell you, a lot of our customers do keep the jars and they reuse them, and we encourage people to do that, and they could be used for anything. I mean, we know people, I've been to Taylor here that on the wall had all different buttons and knickknacks inside the jars.
Cute.
I've had people use it for different things, different whatever it is in the house to store. So there's a lot of different uses that people come up with their containers, but of course everyone loves them. It's the clear jar and it has the screw-on lid, and people like to be able to reuse that.
Right. Well, let's sign off. Before we sign off, I want to mention again, I want you to mention again the name of the person who invented gelato.
Bernardo Buontalenti.
There you go.
His name?
A man of many talents, just like Josh. Josh, thank you so much for joining us
thank
on the menu.
You. Thank you, Peter. Yeah. Thank you, Anne. It was a pleasure speaking to both of you.
Yeah, and you know, he's eaten almost all of it himself. He has a spoon, and he just keeps nibbling at these jars.
Yeah, I was very good, though. After lunch today, I cleaned my teeth, and then it was too late to eat gelato before signing on with Josh.
Well, that's great. We need more people like you. You're our best customers.
Thank you.
Oh, Josh, thanks
thank
so much.
Thank you both. Take care.
Yeah, and good luck to you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And now it's time to take a break so we can sneak off and have some Talenti gelato and an Effie's corn cake to go along with it. So we'll see you on the other side of the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Now, the title of this next book is not as enticing, but it sure is a funny read. And we're going to talk about, and I'm sure I know about this very well, is gourmet meals in crappy little kitchens.
Yeah, a fascinating subject, I'm sure. And eat your heart out, FCC. You know, regulators, after all, so we can call them whatever kinds of kitchens we like.
Well, I have a person, an interviewee, who has a name that rhymes with turtle. Hello, Jennifer Shurtle.
Hi, how are you?
And she has a book title that rhymes with happy.
It's called Gourmet Meals in Crappy Little Kitchens. And as I said to Jen, I immediately gravitated to this book title because I've never known anything but a crappy little kitchen.
And so that's true for most of the population. And I guess, Jen, you must be relying on your experience in the same situation.
Oh, absolutely, because any apartment that I've had has had a crappy little kitchen. But what most people don't realize is 90% of all restaurants have horrible kitchens.
Oh, yes.
And what it is how often do you see anyone build a new restaurant? Chances are that building and that kitchen has been there for 50, 60 years, and you've had several different owners come in and turn a key and restart the operation. But no one gets a brand new kitchen in the professional kitchen industry, and chefs hate buying equipment. There's been so many times where, please, if you just buy me this, it'll make making this so much easier. Nope, do it by hand. I'm not buying you that. So
now, Jennifer, starting out from the beginning, you are a chef. correct?
Yes, I am. I'm right now an executive chef in Dallas, Texas, but I've worked at a couple of different famous Dallas places. If you're familiar with Dallas, you would have heard of The Grape. They've been there 60-something years, and I worked as a pastry chef for 2 years at a really lovely restaurant called Sue's, and they're actually going to be doing a book signing for me coming up and stuff like that.
Oh, that's marvelous. I think about the only place I can remember eating in Dallas is the... there was a nice restaurant on top of the big hotel... Where Prince Charles stayed when he was there, the Adolphus, I think.
Yeah. Now it's owned by Wolfgang Puck, I believe.
Oh, wow. But
yeah,
that was a good restaurant.
He took it over, yeah.
We went to a place that had
Star. Well, I liked it when it was.
Yes.
When we went there, I liked it.
There was a place that had Star or Stars in the title.
Yeah.
Which we didn't rate that all that well. And years ago, we were at the mansion on Turtle Creek, which is just a wee bit pretentious and probably doesn't have a crappy little kitchen either.
Probably not, but you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised.
I guess you're lucky if you don't have a restaurant kitchen that's downstairs. That's what I get so upset about, the poor servers going up and down the stairs.
Uh-huh. But anyway, the aegis of this book was your... professional experience, but also your personal experience of crappy little kitchens. And off the air, before we began, you were sounding just so eloquent about the importance of not just the cooking in a crappy little kitchen, but the process of stocking the kitchen in the first place. So why don't we begin there?
Okay, absolutely. In the book, there's actually a description for how you can build your own pot rack out of just hooks and chain and a barbecue grill. And what's nice about that is storage in a crappy little kitchen is the trickiest part. And so if you can suspend things from your ceiling and from beneath counters and things like that, you're going to be doing yourself a great, great favor. But besides that, don't buy equipment, don't buy pots and pans that you don't have room for. So one saute pan is plenty. One pot is plenty. If you've got equipment that only does one thing, like I use a garlic press all the time as an example, a microplane. People love those microplanes, and I love them too, but it only does one thing. You can have a four-sided box grater that hangs conveniently from your pot rack, and it has the microplane side, it has a large grate side, it has a fine grate side, it's got a mandolin attached to it, and so there's really no reason to have anything that just does one thing.
Now, we must have a crappy, slightly bigger kitchen, because we not only have a microplane, we also have a four-sided microplane grater.
I know.
And we did manage to find out where to put them.
Yeah, people sent that to us. I mean, we didn't buy that.
I've been in homes before where they'll have, four saute pans that are the exact same size. I'm like, only have four burners. Is this just so you never have to wash dishes ever? Why would you need four of the exact same pans?
And you also talk about staples in the kitchen, too. Staples.
Yeah.
There's a list.
Yeah, there's a list that I use of things that are important to me. I always, always, always will have canned tomatoes in my kitchen, really good kosher salt. Most of the recipes in the book actually call for sea salt, and that's just because I feel for a home person, it's an easier place to start. Most chefs use kosher salt because of the consistency.
Yeah, everybody I know has a thing of kosher salt next to the stove.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And anything that's on my list that you think you'll never use, don't buy it just because I said to.
Yeah, I was going to say list has
something
to be,
you need to use.
Yeah, it's the list is going to vary according to the person
and what recipes you're cooking. Basically, every single thing on that list, if you have it in stock, you can at any point make any single recipe in the cookbook. And that's how I came up with the list, is just going through the recipes and saying, okay, red pepper flake comes up several times, saffron comes up several times, coriander, and just wrote it all down. And if you don't use a lot of red pepper flake, then just buy it as you need it, because most grocery stores now have the bulk section where you can buy just a tablespoon. If you've got a recipe calling for smoked paprika, and other than that paella recipe, you're never going to use smoked paprika again the rest of the year, just go to the market and buy a tablespoon of smoked paprika. Just buy what you need, and then you're never storing anything. Herbs and spices, they go stale. What makes them taste nice is the natural oils.
And
the longer
up,
you've had that open container sitting in your pantry, by the time you've used it, that sage that you bought Thanksgiving of 1986, you're wasting your time on that sage. It's not going to taste like anything at all.
We got that great carrot pickle that's...
we do have a jar of carrot pickle. Hot carrot pickle that's been there at least 15 years. I know it.
At least 15 years. But
that's hilarious. They would last a week in my house. I love pickles.
I said it's a pickle. It's not ever going to spoil. And besides, you don't eat it, and I haven't died from it yet, so it must be all right.
Fine.
But then going forward into the cooking process itself, you've mm-hmm. really said, let's go about making things simpler.
Yeah, the other thing people have misconceptions about restaurants is most of those fancy five-star meals you'll buy, especially meats, only have four ingredients, five ingredients max, and I'm including salt and pepper. So most chefs, most restaurants aren't going to have this huge list of ingredients with complicated method because they want to be able to make it to order. They want to make that fresh, and so if it's an insanely difficult ingredient list with an insanely difficult preparation, well, they're not going to be able to do it, and you get your meal on time. And so most of those meals that you have in a fancy restaurant are actually done quite simply and with a relatively small amount of ingredients, and that's what I tried to do. Like some of the soups, four to five ingredients, really, really easy preparation. Whenever I describe cooking a piece of meat or steak, it is a really good cut of steak, salt and pepper. Yeah. People don't realize how important it is to freshly crack your pepper. A pepper mill is one of the things required in the equipment/ingredient list.
Uh-huh.
And again, because of the essential oils, once that pepper is cracked, after a certain amount of time, it starts losing flavor. And I worked at this restaurant before, and we had a very, very simple beef tenderloin. Salt and pepper, that's all that was on there. And someone came back into the kitchen said, oh, what's that spice you put on the steak? I said, pepper. No, it's spicy. What's the spice? Pepper. But no, it was spicy. I'm serious. Freshly cracked pepper, people forget that pepper is pepper. It's supposed to be spicy. The reason if it doesn't taste spicy on your meat at home, it's because you got stale, gross pepper. Throw it away and start over.
Yeah, I was a restaurant critic for 14 years, and I my most hated dining experience was going someplace where the chef couldn't stop and just kept throwing one more ingredient into this. Did I hate that?
Yeah, where are you when we need you, Chris Frangiotis? we know he probably won't hear the program because he disappeared somewhere in the Caribbean.
That's funny.
No, I mean, I was a little curious about the style of photography.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about it. It's kind of unusual. Well, first of all, there's a green striped background to all your little photographs, and they look like recipe cards, sort of.
Yeah, my editor and the design crew for HCI did a really, really, really good job because I am new at this, and so there was a lot of going back and forth of the titles of the recipes and how the page would be laid out and things like that, how many colors to use, and I really am happy with the final product. I feel they did an excellent job.
That's great. Now, when you get into making main courses, uh-huh. you're a great believer in the one-pot approach, right?
Yeah. It's, I call them one-pot wonders, and what's nice about it is I loathe washing dishes, and now everything's all in one pot, so I'm not going to dirty up a bunch of dishes. But from a presentation standpoint, I just love the family style of dining, to where my favorite example of the one-pot wonder is the lamb shepherd's pie. That is just gorgeous. When you pull that Dutch oven out of the stove, it's just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. It's crusty. There's color everywhere, and smoking and bubbling, and it's just beautiful.
It's funny. So, I was reading that recipe just about half an hour ago, and
uh-huh.
It really sounds wonderful. In lamb shank season, we'll have to try it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because my favorite thing to do whenever people ask me what kind of cooking I do, I really don't have a genre or a region that I stick to. My favorite thing is to take something inherently traditional and then breaking it down to its components and changing it up, changing the look, changing the style. You know, usually not changing the flavor profile at all. It is what it is. All the ingredients are present. They're just a little bit different in their presentation or cooking preparation.
Now, here's a bit of a dilemma, though. Because we've been discussing with several chefs braising and saying it's always best if you braise it the day before. But then that creates a storage problem for your
Absolutely.
Crappy little kitchen. So what do you do?
I pretty much just cook everything the day I'm going to serve it. And it is going to develop more flavor as it, in a way, marinates in itself overnight. But, I don't know, chances are most of your guests aren't going to notice that much of a difference. So rather than cooling the shepherd's pie down, sticking it in your refrigerator and warming everything inside the refrigerator up, I just like to pull it fresh from the oven and show it to everybody, and then we all sit down and eat.
Well, you're pretty young, I'm assuming, right?
I just turned 31 in May.
Okay, I thought even maybe younger.
I was very young. Yeah, it makes it great for telemarketers.
Oh,
they
yeah.
They always ask me if my mother's home.
Well, no. You have amazingly strong opinions. I mean, you don't go halfway in this.
Well,
you
I used to
have this thing called
that way. Yeah.
Did you know this crap that section? You say never tried to simulate the flavor or texture of meat in a vegetarian dish because if you do, you will fail.
Yeah, I've never tasted anything vegetarian that was trying to fool me that didn't either fail flavor-wise or textural-wise. Even it could taste great.
Well, what about portobello mushrooms?
Well, exactly, but don't try to make it be a burger. Make it taste like a portobello mushroom.
Well, people who like burgers actually, if they're vegetarian, get just as big a thrill out of having a portobello mushroom sandwich.
Oh, yeah. How I came by that opinion is my respect for vegetarians. The first restaurant I was ever a sous chef in, my boss was really adamant about always having a vegetarian option on the menu, and it wasn't because he was being sweet to vegetarians or anything like that. It's because it drove him absolutely insane to have to pull something out of his rear end, to have to, you know, throw together some sautéed vegetables because someone was a vegetarian. So we always insisted on having a really awesome vegetarian option on the menu, and I kind of saw it as a really great opportunity to try new things.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I say don't try to simulate meat, the best example of that in the book is the tofu lasagna. The tofu doesn't replace meat in the lasagna. The tofu gets sliced really thin and becomes a noodle.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm not trying to fool you to make you think, oh, look at that, that's meat in there. That's not what I'm doing at all. I want each ingredient to be what it is.
Yeah, but I hate those. The vegetarian dishes are shaped to look like pork chops and things.
Yeah, exactly. Don't be silly. But yeah, the mushroom tamales happen very naturally because those wild chanterelle mushrooms, they shred up just beautifully and go perfect inside a tamale, and they look and taste exactly like they should. It still looks like a mushroom. It tastes like a very nice, expensive wild mushroom. And I don't know, texturally, it's just like biting into a tamale.
Now, what restaurant are you at now?
Right now, I'm actually the executive chef at a private surgery facility in that we've got 27 patient rooms. We do all orthopedic surgery, so we do a lot of professional athletes and things like that. And so my boss brought me on to make the menu more spa-like so we can impress the Dallas Cowboys and all that stuff.
Oh, you deal with the Dallas Cowboys?
Yeah, we are the exclusive orthopedic surgeon for the Dallas Cowboys.
Hmm. Well.
I've only got to meet one, so it's not that exciting.
You got any?
I only got to meet one.
You got any Tony Romo stories?
Nope, haven't met Tony Romo. Yeah, it's funny, they only, I actually met more cowboy people. I met several cowboy wives before I had this job, though. Before I had this job, I did a lot of cooking, like live demonstration cooking, and we would also do private cooking classes. And the Dallas Cowboy wives hang out once a month doing stuff all together.
Oh, okay.
And they all got together and did a cooking class at my restaurant. I got to meet Jason Witten's wife, and she is lovely, incredibly lovely. But yeah, most of the Cowboys I've never heard of. I'm not a big football fan.
Okay.
I'm more of a baseball fan.
So what can you do?
Come
to the city.
I remember thinking I felt bad that I didn't know who, because they'd tell me who their husband was. I'm like, okay, I don't know who that is.
Well, come to Pittsburgh, and you'll be You'll have to get involved.
I know. I don't know. I'd probably still end up watching the Pirates.
No,
much more of a baseball fan.
You would not watch the
Pirates. You would not watch
the Pirates. I promise you would not watch the Pirates.
Have you seen how bad Texas does in baseball right now between the Astros and the Rangers? I don't know what to do.
Well, we're so far ahead of them in the loss win stakes. It's ridiculous. But
yeah.
we shouldn't get onto that subject. That will make us. That will make
we're
us
all going to be sad.
The next thing you can do is cooking for a crappy little football team.
All right, crappy little baseball team.
Oh,
doing the
dear.
Best they can.
Well, anyhow, this is not only just a fun book, listeners. This is a book to help most of us out because, I mean, I found that the ones that have these gorgeous, big, up-to-the-minute modern kitchens, they hardly ever cook. They go out for dinner. So the rest of us have got to get adjusted to having a little space for storage, streamlining all the equipment that we use, streamlining all our pantry, and you tell us all how to do that, and that's great, and it's fun along the way because you make up quirky names, titles for your recipes.
How to make it entertaining.
And you make it entertaining.
Yeah, because there's so much pride involved with making a really great meal when you've had to overcome circumstances. And so having a great meal inside a crappy little kitchen, I feel, is actually more exciting than a gourmet meal in a beautiful, immaculate kitchen. Obviously, if you've got a beautiful, immaculate kitchen, you can still use this book.
Yeah.
The recipes are sound. You can make any recipe in this book in any sort of kitchen. But the people
they're
are trying to help out are the people like me.
Well, thank you very much. And Jen, shirtled around the turtle. I'm sure our paths will cross again.
I hope so. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Bye-bye.
And now one more break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station. www.aspstation.net.
Here we are, and we're following. I think you've probably figured out now that it's a really hot trend, is a return to what our grandmothers did, canning, preserving, jamming. And this is one of several books we got on the subject, and it's one of the most thorough. It's called Put 'em Up, and it's a very clever book as well.
Yeah, so put up your dukes and can.
Put 'em up. I'm saying that to our guest, Sherry Brooks Vinton, because that's the name of her book. And it is subtitled, A Comprehensive Home Preserving Guide for the Creative Cook, From Drying and Freezing to Canning and Pickling.
That's a long title, huh?
Well, this book, Sherry, covers just about anything you possibly want in the preservation food.
Well, the goal was to give eaters a variety of solutions that they could use when they come home from the farmer's market or the U-Pick, or when their backyard garden kind of comes into flourish and they might find themselves with a little surplus of good things from the harvest.
So they'll either have a surplus that they've created, or they'll have a surplus that they can buy it at an inexpensive price in a local grocery store or a farmer's market?
I would say farmer's market over a grocery store, because when you're preserving food, you want to buy produce that's at the peak of flavor. So oftentimes the industrialized produce that you find in the grocery store has traveled on average 1,500 miles from the field to the point of sale, and in that process has perhaps lost some flavor along the way.
Yeah, well, we had two versions before more recently we started preserving more things. I guess there were two things that started out being preserved in our household. First of all, Anne's mother was a wonderful gardener, so we had an intensive city gardening plot, which, like all city gardening plots, of course, produces all the tomatoes at the same time and all the peppers at the same time, so you can't use them, so you have to put them up, and she did that.
Back before that. I mean, we had a huge garden growing up, and always everything was canned.
Well, I'm just talking about the things I remember. Yeah. Now, the other thing that happened along about the same time is blueberries come in, have a very short season when they're very inexpensive, and I'll have fruit for breakfast every morning, which Anne makes, and she had this brilliant idea that she could freeze blueberries individually so they wouldn't all stick together.
No, my mother did that because she used to
do that. Okay.
She also measured them out exactly what she needed for blueberry pie, and that's what
I
thought. Remember the roast where you cut off the bit to fit the pan?
Right.
Well, this is how we got into these plastic bags with blueberries, because they were measured out for one blueberry pie.
But we live in Pittsburgh, so the blueberries, when they come into season and they're at their lowest price, at least they've only traveled about 300 miles.
Yeah, but basically I wanted to establish that you are at crest of a trend we're riding. I hope it stays around and is not a trend for people to get back to what our ancestors did in terms of canning, preserving, and so forth.
I think you've really hit on something there, and I don't think it's a trend. I think that we've just had a little taste of agriculture gone wrong and want to get back to a system that makes more sense. And you don't have to be a scientist. It's more of a common sense movement. We want food that tastes wonderful and that isn't raised with a lot of chemistry from people that are serious about flavor and providing wholesome food. Going back to a more regional
food system.
Now, before we came on the air, you were talking about there was really a trigger event, Damascene, I guess is the word, event that caused you to really focus your attention on this subject.
That's right, Peter. I was on a cross-country motorcycle trip with my husband, and we came face-to-face with the negative impacts of industrial agriculture when we got out to the middle of the country and saw the kind of factory farming that was really putting small family farms out of business. And when we returned home, I started digging around and didn't have to dig too deeply to find that there's an alternative food system operating all around us. And once you plug into it, you have the most delicious meal you'll ever enjoy.
Now tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I get my food, and I hope I see more people these days doing the same, from local farmers that are raising their crops without a lot of chemistry, with really great sensitivity to natural resources. And the food tastes delicious, and I know that it's being raised sustainably. It's actually enriching the soil rather than depleting it.
So those are the ideas that started off the book. Now, preserving sort of, to me, started out, I started about thinking jam, like jam which my mother used to make and pickles which my aunt used to make. But you have preserving across a wide variety of different areas, including just simply freezing. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about how you organize the subject so that people know that this is going to be a really useful guide to them?
Well, preserving doesn't have to be an all-day affair. As much as I love to spend a good day in the kitchen, sometimes you don't have the time or inclination to do so. So what I've tried to do in Put 'em Up is to offer eaters a wide variety of preserving solutions that give them the opportunity to preserve part of the harvest in as little as sometimes 10 minutes. So that when they come home with an extra flat of strawberries or their zucchini has just gone wild in the back garden, that they can, with just a little bit of time and effort, put some of that away so that they can enjoy it in the fallow season and so that it doesn't go to waste.
Now, you call these techniques, I think I might call them methods. So what are the main methods?
Well, you can freeze your food. You can dry it. Canning is a great way, using the boiling water method to put by some of your food, or fermenting vegetables is another option as well. And some of these only take 10 minutes and a piece of string to string up some chilies and dry them in your kitchen, for example. So it doesn't have to be complicated. It can be very fast, very simple, and very delicious.
Now, you start out with blanching, which has always been a bit of a mystery to me.
Well, blanching is just a term for dropping produce into a pot.
Anne's laughing at me, and she's probably rightly so. But it just seems so scientific, and then you explain it. It's all really very simple.
Like many of the techniques in the book, they are quite simple. And blanching is just a matter of dropping produce into a pot of boiling water, scooping it out, and plunging it into an ice bath to stop the cooking. And by doing so, you make fruits and vegetables easier to pack or easier to remove their skins. And you also deactivate the natural enzymes in the food so that it doesn't deteriorate as rapidly.
Okay, so what you've done is essentially you've aided with the preservation of that.
That's right. It's particularly helpful when you're removing skins from tomatoes, or when you want to, for example, freeze green beans and you want to blanch those first so that they last longer in the freezer.
You know, I discovered something when my mother was alive, she put up over 100 tomato plants and she planted them, and we ended up with a lot of tomatoes. And she became ill, and there was this garden, and I was taking care of her, and I wasn't able to deal with the garden. And I found you could get big plastic bags, wash the tomatoes whole, dry them, and throw them in the bag and freeze them, and they were fine.
Yeah, she didn't even blanch them.
Right. That's one of the techniques that I offer in the book. Rather than throwing them into the bag, I recommend that people take the whole tomatoes, put them on a cookie sheet, and freeze them.
and then put them into storage bags so that they're individually frozen. You don't wind up with that big tomato burk that is bagged. But when you do that, you can freeze them with the skins on, and then when you take them out of the freezer, you just run the tomatoes under some water, and the skins will slip off as if they've been blanched.
Let's aim directly at what has been for a long time perceived as a problem. I still remember a friend of mine's mother was constantly telling her she was going to kill somebody with canning her tomatoes. And I still remember the canned goods on the steps to the basement in my home where some of the bottles would kind of push the lids off and bubble over. What is the risk factor in preserving things? And the other one is infusing things. I had heard some bad things about botulism with garlic-infused stuff.
Right. Well, there are some rules that you have to follow when you're preserving your own food, but they really don't stretch the realms of what you would call maybe a common kitchen, common sense kind of things. You need to keep things clean, but not sterile. And the methods that I present have wide margins for error. So you're not going to kill anyone if you follow the recipe. In generations past, there were some techniques that people used, and they still ask me about when I give presentations, that I don't recommend people use and have kind of gone out of favor for that very reason.
Like what?
That they were a little bit, not dangerous, but they just left open the possibility that bacteria would enter the jars. People used to do a form of canning called open kettle canning, where they would sterilize their jars and set them out on their counter, and then they would prepare their recipe, ladle it into the jars, and then just put a lid on them. And in doing so, they opened up the possibility for bacteria to enter the jars as they were being filled. There's always bacteria in the air, so, you know, oftentimes they would find that these things would go bad on the shelf. But we have improved methods so that it doesn't happen, because we don't just fill the jars and put them on the shelves. We fill them, and then we use what's called the boiling water method, where they go into a pot of boiling water, and that process kills off any residual bacteria, so that once they come out of that boiling water, they can safely be stored on the shelf for up to a year.
So if you follow the instructions in the book, you're going to be perfectly fine. If you don't take it seriously, then you're taking a risk, and you really should be more careful.
Well, it's just like baking. There are rules to follow, and if you follow them, you'll have successful results. And I actually think canning is much easier than baking. I'm a much better canner than I am a baker.
Oh, me too.
But really, it's just common sense practices, making sure that you are following the recipe, and you'll have delicious results.
So you've got the first part of the book is these methods that we talked about, or the techniques that we talked about, and then the second part of the book is a set of recipes dealing with things that would be commonly available. You can follow the steps for each one of them.
That's right. The second part of the book is broken down by produce item. So
that's I think, very useful. If somebody wants to, is stuck with like two baskets or a peck and a half of yellow tomatoes, they just have to go and look under the item in your book.
And it's so clever because it's organized alphabetically.
Well,
so carrots come before cherries, and cherries come before tomatoes.
It's a very common sense book.
There you go. It sounds like a great idea. And pictures, too.
Yes, we really wanted people to feel like when they picked up the book that they had company in the kitchen. Canning is a great social activity, and I have a great time getting a bunch of friends together, and you know, sometimes we'll open up a bottle of wine or brew up a pot of tea and just start putting by tomatoes, and you have a good gossip session, and then you walk away with dinner.
Now, you did mention in the book that you actually do a little bit of fiddling around with spirituous things, and although they're not in that book, they might be in a future one.
Well,
something about moonshine.
Well, that's my family is a long line of moonshiners. I don't brew any of my own spirits and don't have recipes for brewing in the book, but what I do have are infusions, where you take spirits and infuse them with the flavor of various produce items. And it's just a great way to capture the flavor of fresh off the vine food.
Yeah, well, moonshine's making a comeback too. There's a book out called Chasing the White Dog. Did you know that?
Yes, I had heard that. My family did not write that book.
I think we have it somewhere.
Well, some of this that was a little bit extreme, like making your own raisins. Why would somebody want to make their own raisins? I guess if you had a big crop of grapes, huh?
Well, there are a variety of solutions to working with surplus produce, and yes, if you have grapes growing in your backyard and you're done making your jams and your jellies, then raisins are a fine thing to do. When you're drying produce, like grapes, for example, you can work with any quantity that you have on hand. So it's a great solution if you just have a few cups, a couple handfuls of extra grapes, and then you can dry them, and it's a delicious solution for these foods, and it's also a great experiment if you have kids around for them to understand where food comes from.
Yeah, that's important. I have to ask you a question. Is, with all the possibilities, what is your preferred method of preserving herbs? Because I end up with huge quantities of herbs from my herb garden.
My favorite thing to do with many fresh herbs is just to wrap a length of twine around the stem ends and hang them from the beams in my kitchen and let them dry.
Well, I used to do that, and I have an old stove that still has a pilot light, and you can put them on a cookie sheet and put them in there. But you lose drying herbs, except for oregano, I guess. You lose all the essential oils. So my quest has been to figure out how to preserve herbs without doing that.
Well, another method is to take your bouquet of herbs and puree them with a little bit of cooking oil, olive oil, and then pour that into an ice cube tray, pop it in the freezer, and when they're solid enough to hold their shape, you can transfer them into a freezer bag and have them on hand. They're wonderful to just let melt over top of some grilled steak, or you can stir them into pasta or puree them with a little bit of vinegar and have an instant vinaigrette.
See, the only thing you were doing differently was you didn't put any oil in it.
Well, no, I mean, I didn't want to put the oil in because I wanted them not to have oil in it.
Okay.
So what I did, Sherry, was I had a lot of parsley, and I took and I washed it and dried it, or I washed it, and then I poked it in really tightly packed into ice cube trays with just a little water, and then froze them, and then transferred them to a...
That's exactly what you said, except she suggested putting in a little oil in it.
Well,
you don't have to use the oil. You can use water.
Yeah, that's
you
right.
You can do that, too. But then I find that you know, that's not something that I want to melt on top of a piece of grilled fish.
No,
with
what we've
the water
been doing is we've actually rinsed the water off and just chopped up as if that we're using fresh parsley.
Yeah.
It's green.
Or in some cases, if the stew or whatever it is we're cooking needs liquid anyway, then you put the cube in whole and it just adds water to the recipe like you want.
Right.
Well, this is a fascinating subject, and I'm sure this is not going to be the end of your writing adventures in this area, Sherry, so I hope you'll keep in touch with us and let us know what you're going to do next so that we can invite you back on the program and we can talk some more.
I would love to do it.
So meanwhile, listeners, remember, it's Sherry Brooks Vinton, and the book is called Put 'Em Up, and you have a website, Sherry. Why don't you give our listeners your website?
The website is www.sherrybrooksvinton.com.
And it's Sherri.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. And it's a very, very useful book. Congratulations on it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. And I see you're a member of Women Chef and Restaurateurs, too.
I am. And IACP and Slow Food.
Well, thank you again very much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Bye.
Bye now.
So there you have it, listeners, another On the Menu program in the bag. We hope you enjoyed it, and you'll join us again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.